We'll be talking now about understanding the transformation of our Wisconsin ecology. Our guest, by way of telephone, Don Waller, is co-editor of The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Don is a professor in the Institute for Cross College Biology and the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Botany, and is currently on sabbatical leave in France. And so we've got him on, even though he's normally here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we've got him online from France to talk with us about the book that he co-edited with Tom Rooney, Thomas Rooney. Something from the book jacket here from David Foster of Harvard University. It summarizes a little bit here. He says, written by a collection of the world's great ecologists, geographers, and wildlife biologists, The Vanishing Present provides an insightful and comprehensive synthesis of the natural and human history of the Wisconsin landscape. And indeed, it does. I'm really pleased to have Don Waller with us. Don, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure, Larry. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you as well. Well, this is really a fascinating book, and as I read through it and tried to decide how to approach interviewing you about it, I was in a bit of a quandary because there are, I think, pretty much every chapter in this book could be a topic for my program in and of itself.
So yes, we've got a big elephant, and we're all blind men trying to feel one part or another of it at a time. That's why we felt the need for 32 chapters and 50 authors. And even so, I'm sure we sold the subject short. But it is the first attempt, we think, to really try and get a handle on one part of the world and how it's changed ecologically, say, over the past 100 or 200 years.
Well, it's a fascinating read. That's for sure. What is it about Wisconsin is unique and worth a book of this nature?
Oh, Wisconsin is very special, as the people who live here know. We're kind of a meeting ground between the prairies to the west of us and the forest to the east of us and the sort of more boreal forest up to the north, where it's got Great Lakes on a couple of sides. We know both the tornadoes and squall lines of summer thunderstorms, as well as those brutal north winds in the wintertime. So Wisconsin's prairies and wetlands and forests have inspired generations of naturalists and leaders, important leaders in the conservation movement, including John Muir, Aldo Leopold, Gaylord Nelson, and John Curtis, I would include among those too.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And, of course, all of those folks are mentioned, some in depth, in your book. But maybe it would be a good idea for you to talk about how you've organized the book, why you organized it the way you did, and how it's organized.
Well, we had a lot of discussion about that, Larry. We thought at first we should talk about habitats, and then we had arguments and said, no, we should talk about groups of organisms, you know, the plants and the fish and the mammals and the birds. And in the end, we did a mixture of both because we felt as though we really had to approach Wisconsin from these different directions to get a feel for what was going on statewide. And we also have some chapters, of course, on the policies that are affecting our own environment these days and how those have changed in the past and might change in the future.
And you've got the book into, I think, about, was it six parts, isn't it? Six parts.
That's right, yeah. So we start, because I'm a botanist, we start with the plants. After a couple of chapters on perspectives, we got Aldo Leopold's daughter, Nina Leopold Bradley, and a student of mine to do a chapter on climate change and how that's affecting the phenology of birds and flowers in the state of Wisconsin. And we also felt the need, having stolen the idea for the book, really, and the title in part from my colleague John Magnuson. He wrote a paper in 1990 called The Invisible Present, about how oblivious we tend to be to ecological change. And that idea really stuck in our heads. We really thought a lot about that and how true it is. We see short-term studies that students do for a couple of years. We see paleontologists looking back over thousands of years. And we're curiously blind to the kinds of slow-moving but ultimately rather dramatic ecological changes that are going on all around us these days.
And I think that's that thought is present in virtually every part of your book. The fact that that change does occur, for the most part, change really pretty slowly.
Well, it depends on how you define that, Larry. I'd say it's moving very quickly from the point of view of an evolutionary biologist or the point of view of a geologist. It is moving slowly from our human attention. You don't see every night on the evening news, you know, the latest breaking account of declines in grassland birds or, you know, people lamenting the loss of the American burying beetle. And yet, these are changes that are going on around us. It's what Wilson has referred to, Ed Wilson, as a slow-moving catastrophe.
Yeah. Well, let's give our listeners a chance to join in. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment as we move along in talking with Don Waller, co-editor of The Vanishing Present, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. And the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Give us a call or send us an email. We'll be happy to get you on. Part two of your book, you talk about our changing plant communities in Wisconsin. And maybe you could discuss that a little bit. How have things changed over time with our plant communities?
You know, that's an interesting thing, Larry. We just had a paper accepted, and I think it has a pretty dramatic punchline. We've seen, in my field of ecology, we've seen a century of study of people going out into the forest or the prairie, and they study the soils, and they study the climate, the temperature, and the precipitation. Or if they're in a forest, they look at how much light is coming down. And they've tried to predict the ecological community based on these local environmental conditions. And in the past, that worked. And what we're finding today, however, is that it doesn't work anymore. If you want to describe the plants that are growing inside a forest in southern Wisconsin, you can look at the soil, you can look at the overstory, and they would have told you a lot about what was there 50 years ago. But today, the best predictors of the plants that are growing in that forest are what's going on in the landscape around that forest. How many houses are there? How many roads? How big are the patches of forest? How connected are they together? In other words, landscape context is emerging as more and more important over time as we pay what some call the extinction debt associated with the shrinking, more fragmented habitats in our world today.
We have callers online who want to visit with you, Don, so I want to go to the phones here. Susan in Pewaukee is up first. Susan, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I am very curious, wondering if he has information on migratory bird paths and a conflict with all of these windmills that are up to generate the energy that we need. And seeing, I can't remember his first name, Pickens, who is promoting this for our energy. And someone did ask the question, and he literally laughed about it and just brushed it off and went on without a real comment.
And, no, that's nothing we should laugh at. I'm surprised T. Boone Pickens would have done that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm wondering if there have been any studies or is there any hope that if it would help, I'm assuming they do impact the birds, that maybe there would be studies so that they could only put them up in certain areas where they would, you know, cause less harm.
Well, that's, of course, a topic of concern. If we're going to move to a sustainable society, we have to figure out how to generate and use energy more economically, and the energy we do use should be generated in a sustainable manner. There's a lot of excitement about wind, and I think that's for a good reason. Here in Wisconsin, we have seen declines in birds, particularly in neotropical migrant songbirds, in our forested communities, and particularly even more than that in grassland birds, associated with intensification of agriculture and the loss of prairie communities. My own concerns about windmills, and by the way, birds are killed by the thousands in collisions with antenna towers, cell phone towers, tall buildings, and so on. It's a serious source of mortality. And it's also true that birds sometimes hit windmills. However, that tends to occur when windmills are placed in migratory corridors. Here in Wisconsin, we have the Mississippi and Wisconsin rivers, which are major migration corridors. We also have the shore of Lake Michigan, which is a corridor. But it's my understanding that these days, wind farms like the one we have south west of Madison have been sighted in areas that are not on conspicuous migration routes, and that most of the bird migration that occurs in those areas is above the altitude at which those things are operating. I'm not saying that birds never get hit. I'm saying that, to my knowledge, I don't think it's a serious source of mortality in the windmills we've got in the state.
All right. Thank you, Susan, for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Kenosha, we're on to you next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that as a college student who's taking American environmental history right now, it's really great to see that people are looking at it from a perspective and getting more people to read about it by publishing these books, and it's great to see that someone's actually written something about Wisconsin in particular, and I'm very happy to hear about that.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And
that was our motivation, and hearing that comment makes my day. I mean, it's fine for scientists to talk to each other and share their own stories, but it's another thing to try and reach a broader audience, and that was really our goal with this book.
Yeah, sounds like a good book. I'd like to read it. So, yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Don Waller, is co-editor of The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife, published by the University of Chicago Press. And he'll be visiting with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really pleased today to have with us Don Waller. Don is the co-editor of the book The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And in the book, we have 32 chapters that cover the full range of ecosystems and organisms, including past history, present status, and future challenges. Written by 50, we have 50 authors for these 32 chapters. So I'm really pleased to have Don with us to talk about the book, The Vanishing Present, and about the challenges that we face to our Wisconsin ecology. If you'd like to join in with a question or comment as we move along today, I hope you will, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Greg in Green Bay has been waiting a long time, so I want to get Greg on the air and a chance to participate here, Don. Greg, thank you for calling. Hello.
Sure. Thank you. It's a really interesting topic to me. And I'm a hunter and fisherman, and I'm just as a comment, I'm guessing as a whole and a majority, there's probably no group that's more interested in what you've got to say probably than hunting and fishing people as a whole. I'm sure there's the bad apples like anything, but My question or my comment is, I always say something, and I'd love to get your opinion and see if I'm out of turn when I say it. I'm an avid grouse hunter, and you know, more and more as I see, you know, I'm 43 and I've been doing it 35 years. I see, you know, we don't do the clear cutting like we used to in Wisconsin in many counties, and in turn, I see the grouse numbers down. I see the areas that are, you know, good habitat for the grouse down. And I always make the comment, I said, you know, Mother Nature used to have a way to keep the grouse numbers up, and it was called a forest fire. You know, people that aren't in favor of the clear cutting want to leave the select cutting there. And when I walk into a select cut forest, what I see is nothing. I see no deer. I see no rabbits. I see no bear. Nothing. And so I always make that comment that I said, you know, we've lost sight of what Mother Nature used to do, and I always say it was a forest fire. And I guess, you know, if I'm off base in saying that, correct me, or just maybe comment. That's my comment.
All right, Greg, thank you for calling. Don?
Sure, Greg. First of all, I'd agree with you that fishermen and hunters and let's count bird watchers and hikers in amongst those, kayakers and canoeists, are usually the ones who are outside and in a position to notice more what's going on. I appreciate your observations, and I think they're accurate to a point. And in particular, you brought up the issue of disturbance. If you're talking about ecological change, you, of course, have to concern yourself with disturbance. And disturbance has changed a lot. You suggested fires aren't as common now as they used to be, and that's certainly true if you go just back 100 years or 120 or 30 years. But if you go back hundreds of years, we could look at some studies that indicate where fires did and didn't happen on our sand plains, on our sand barrens, like the Moqua Barrens up in Bayfield County and similar areas. Fires burned very regularly, and you're absolutely right. That's an essential part of the system. It resets the successional clock. It creates open habitat, not just for grouse, but for lots of other species, and it's a normal part of the ecology. However, there are other parts of the forest that were typically on richer, thicker soils where the forest cover was thicker and darker. They tended to be humid in the understory to the point where an ecologist friend of mine who studies forests called them the asbestos forest. They were pretty much unburnable in those days. And they, of course, those were all mostly clear-cut, and at that point, some of them became burnable. But at any rate, that's what you're seeing now with those successional changes going on gradually as trees mature. It does tend to squeeze out some wildlife like grouse, and until it reaches a point. I mean, the thing with succession is we're kind of halfway through it. Our forests were mostly leveled by 1920 or so. And so we're sort of in a mid-successional state right now that a lot of ecologists, and you too evidently, think of as kind of a nadir, a kind of a low point in terms of wildlife populations. Now, there are two things you can do. One is what you suggested about moving towards clear-cutting, creating more open habitat, and that might improve things for grouse in that area for a while. And another thing you can do is wait a while longer until you get truly older growth conditions where the canopy breaks up. You have tree fall gaps. This is what disturbances used to be. They were variable in scale, from small to big. They came at variable times. The thing about clear cutting is it tends to be regular like a clock and simplifying in a kind of a different way. So there are two ways to get grouse. One is to wait a while longer and wait for that canopy to open up in places on its own, sometimes with fire or ice storms or floods or whatever. But the other way is with clear cutting. And I can see we've already probably spent enough time on the topic, but I really appreciate your input and interest in this. And I think it's showing the kinds of choices we face in Wisconsin today about managing particularly our forest lands.
Yeah, and just as we look at our forest lands, the tree species and so forth have changed considerably, if I'm not mistaken, in part because of invasive species.
Yeah, we spent some time in the book on invasions and invasive species. It's disturbing to me to see as many weeds as we do see coming into our waters, you know, with zebra mussels and quahog mussels and spiny water fleas and a whole succession of introduced and invading fish species. We've got the same kind of thing with weedy shrubs and trees coming in. We've got West Nile virus in our birds populations, you know, birds dropping and dying from a disease that's from half a world away. We've got a general tendency towards homogenization going on in many of our ecosystems. The common species, the pervasive ones, the weedy ones, are doing fine. They're thriving in today's world. And the ones that are particular, the ones that are unique, the ones that are more specialized in their habitat needs, are generally the ones that have been declining and disappearing. And so we're getting a world that's kind of more homogenous, you know, sort of like the shopping mall that looks the same in one city as it does in every other.
In part three of your, you mentioned waters, and that reminded me, in part three of your book, you talk about the story, I guess, of the changing waters and the land-water interface. Joy Zedler has a nice essay, and they're on wetlands, for example.
We've lost about half of our wetlands in Wisconsin and about half of our wetlands in the United States from what we had originally. And, you know, we almost lost sandhill cranes. They've made a nice comeback. I want to emphasize that our book on ecological change isn't all about, you know, scary stories or sad stories. We tell the positive stories, too, and we take great hope and encouragement from the fact that sandhill cranes have made a good comeback. And Joy Zedler's chapter on wetlands is also a chapter that has some hope in it. I mean, we're learning a lot about how to reconstruct, how to restore communities and get something back that provides good habitat for wildlife and fish. And again, Wisconsin is a pioneer in this field. It was John Curtis and Aldo Leopold that started the Arboretum, and the Arboretum is a world center for restoration ecology. It's something that our state has really been unique about.
Sally in Spring Green, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Sally.
Good morning. There's a whole row of wind turbines down through west central Illinois on the same route is now being used by the whooping cranes in back of the ultralights. So that's a big worry, though they did get passed to Florida this year. And then there was some large controversy over putting wind turbines next to Horkin Marsh. Did that go through? I don't know.
This is an issue, an important issue, the siting of wind turbines. As I tried to emphasize before, I think there are good places for wind turbines, and I think there are bad places for wind turbines. I'm not an authority on this particular topic, but it's my understanding from the papers that I've read that the incidence of bird strikes is quite low on turbines that are not in major migratory pathways. Bats are another issue. We're very concerned about Indiana bats in Wisconsin, and there's some evidence in the eastern United States that they have a tendency to get caught up in a vortex around one of these wind turbine blades. But I'm not aware of a direct threat to whooping cranes or other cranes from these wind turbines. It's my understanding the whooping cranes are being guided by ultralight aircraft, which I'm sure give a wide berth around any obstruction, including wind turbines.
Yeah.
But if anyone else knows more about this, I encourage them to call in.
Let's go to Rick. Thank you, Sally. Let's go to Rick in La Crosse. Rick, hello to you.
Yeah, I got a comment and a kind of a question. I'm 52 years old. I've been involved in farming and agriculture for most of my life, and I've just noticed the change from back in the 60s and 70s to from crop rotation with alfalfa, corn, oats, various other crops, and to now it's just monocropping soybeans and corn with heavy chemicals, and how this has impacted the wildlife. You just don't see as many birds. You used to see pastures with cattle, and they've tore up a lot of pastures and CRP lands. For, you know, as far as ethanol and biodiesel, and I just think we're just going backwards as far as the ecology situation.
Well, thanks for calling, Rick. Don, a comment from you.
Rick, I can't agree with you more. I think you've put your finger on one of the biggest issues we face right now in terms of ecological change. I mentioned that grassland birds were declining more than any other birds in the state of Wisconsin. That's directly a consequence of agriculture, and as I understand it, particularly the more frequent mowing for hay in those fields going up from one or two times a season to three times a season. And as you said, the intensification, the movement towards shorter rotations and intensive corn and soybean production. I think we should take a serious look at our agriculture. That's especially with biofuels, increasing demand, food prices going up, a lot of farmers taking their land out of the CRP program, which was set up to protect those marginal habitats where agriculture really isn't the ideal use of the land. I think this is perhaps one of the most important issue that we really face right now in Wisconsin about ecological change.
Yeah. Rick, again, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Again, you can join in with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org as we talk with Donald Waller about the book he's edited with Thomas Rooney. It's called The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. Ron in Madison, let's turn to you now. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I wonder what the authors and contributors forecast for the next several centuries. My overwhelming concern, I guess, in this regard is long-lived trees which have heavy seeds, that these are species that we need to help migrate north. For example, the trees that grew in Wisconsin during the 19th century might be suited to different niches up in Ontario during the 21st, 22nd, 23rd centuries, whereas trees from Missouri and Arkansas will probably be the ones that can survive the Wisconsin climate during the 23rd century. Sometime later, maybe 300 or 3,000 years from now, perhaps other humans can help the trees migrate back to where they really belong. But of all the different species that we can be concerned about, I think things like walnuts, pecans, oaks, hickories need our help now to get to where they can survive 100 years from now. And I wondered if you thought of other species, and is it possible that perhaps in some of those clear cuts in Wisconsin that still happen occasionally, we can bring in communities, forest communities from Arkansas, and get them transplanted here, including the wildlife species that thrive in those forest communities.
All right, Ron, thank you.
That's an interesting point, Ron, and it's something that's getting a lot of discussion these days. Plants, populations, of course, have migrated in response to climate change for hundreds of thousands and millions of years, in fact. But what we're talking about now is a rate of climate change, or I've got a friend now who's calling it climate breakdown, that's orders of magnitude faster than anything that's been seen in a very, very long time. So the question is, can plants keep up with it, especially large-seeded trees? I think it's an open question. We've got a couple of problems here. One is the speed of climate change. The other is how fragmented our habitats are. We used to have a lot of more mature forests, and it was all connected to one another. Now these are broken up into smaller pieces that are often separated from one another by significant barriers. So there are people who are seriously proposing moving seeds north. We've seen the map that the climate of Arkansas is what Wisconsin will be like in the future. I don't know if we can be as sort of simplistic as to just assume that we need to go down to Arkansas now and pick up these heavy nuts or big-seeded species and move them into Wisconsin now. There are a lot of complexities here. I've done one study myself, for example, on aspen, looking back at tree rings and how fast the trees are growing. And we have evidence that the rate of aspen growth has accelerated a lot in the last 60 or 70 years in response to increasing CO2 in the atmosphere, which, of course, is food for plants. So some trees and some plants are obviously taking advantage of the changes that are going on in the environment around them. But the degree to which they can take advantage of it is going to be limited both by the genetic variation that they have and by these barriers to their own dispersal. So good issue. I don't have any simple answer there.
And thank you for calling. Helene in Lake Delton, your turn. Hi, Helene.
Thank you, Larry. I want to talk about my pet peeve as to one of the problems that contributes to eliminating grasslands for the birds to nest in, the ground nesting birds. And that's the landowners out in the country who mow all along their property, whether it's 20 rods or 40 rods from the road, from the roadside surface, clear to a fence line, if there is a fence line, or clear to the crop, if there's no fence along there. And that just, it's bothered me for years that
that happens. Well, I tell you what, Don, a comment from you?
You're right, and I really appreciate the perspective of older people. I find as I get older myself, I notice these things more, and it's because the changes we see tend to happen, as I said, incrementally. And individually, they don't seem like a big deal, but collectively, they've had a massive influence on things like these grassland birds. I agree with you. We shouldn't be managing this land so intensively. We should leave hedgerows. We should be cropping less intensively and less often to let the grass grow up in areas that can provide good nest cover. Grassland birds that used to get off a nice clutch of eggs and nestlings by the end of June are now having their nests smashed and their young destroyed by, you know, a harvester coming through in the middle of June or whatever, or even earlier. So it's the problem is the farmer needs to have some incentives here, is how I'm beginning to look at it. We've told farmers in the past to go for maximum production yield per acre. We've given them massive subsidies in the United States to produce primarily corn and soybeans, cotton, of course, down south. And it seems to me we need to reorder those incentives. We need to figure out what the ecological costs and benefits are of different kinds of land use and land management, and begin to structure both our agricultural incentives and programs like the Managed Forest Law, the MFL, to give rewards to landowners who are pursuing simultaneously an economic activity and have some interest in conservation.
Yeah. Thank you, Helene, for calling. Derek and Shoto, we go to you next. Hi, Derek.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to know if you had discovered anything about the impact of suburban sprawl on the ecology of Wisconsin. Urban planning is sort of an interest of mine. And, you know, it's my understanding that there's a lot of negative impacts, you know, that can be brought mm-hmm. upon, in, you know, an ecosystem from suburban sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I taught a course on urban sprawl with a colleague, Harvey Jacobs, and I've also made that a part of my online course on Midwestern ecological issues. I consider sprawl, which is, by the way, is larger in the Midwest than it is on the either coast in the United States. It's gobbling up habitat at a terrific rate, both farmland and natural habitat. It's associated with significant declines in water quality. I consider it a rather significant issue that tends to get ignored. I'm living in France this semester while I'm on sabbatical, and one of the reasons I'm here, I sometimes tell my students to go to Western Europe if they want to see the future of North America in another couple of hundred years or maybe less. But I'm also interested in how people can manage to live in compactly in small cities while using far less energy and controlling big issues like suburban sprawl. It's again, like agriculture, it's one of the most significant issues we face in Wisconsin, and we have not addressed it adequately yet.
And I'm recalling one of the articles in the book. Dave Cheslevich has a nice piece in your book about sprawl.
Thanks, Larry. He calls it the city ethic. And he in fact, used to work for the Nature Conservancy at an earlier point in his career. He's figured out that making sustainable, livable, fun, enjoyable cities is absolutely necessary and important if we're going to address our broader environmental issues. And I think he's right. I'm trying to get him over here, by the way.
Oh, good. Well, I'm wondering, just in the last minute or a minute and a half, any thought that you want to leave our listeners with today, Don?
I would urge them to pay attention. I would urge them to look beyond the headlines of tonight's news, look beyond the big story about the economic crisis that we're having or the new administration. I'd urge them to pay attention to this thing that happens a little bit more slowly. If they could watch a movie of how their habitats had changed over the last 40 years or the last 100 years, if they could sit down and just watch that in 1 hour, I think they'd be alarmed. They'd be concerned. They might be appalled to see all the changes that have happened and all the losses of things that have come along. And it's not all losses. There have been some nice recoveries and restoration in some areas, and I think those hold a lot of hope for the future. But I'd urge listeners to ponder this issue of ecological change and not to limit. I mean, we tend to pay a lot of attention to climate breakdown or climate change now. It's a bigger picture than that. Ecological change is a really complex, fascinating, and hugely important issue for every resident of Wisconsin.
Don, thank you very much for being with us today. I've enjoyed your book and enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you, Larry. I've enjoyed it, too.
Donald Waller, co-editor of the book The Vanishing Present, Wisconsin's Changing Lands, Waters, and Wildlife. Fascinating book. And Don edited this along with Thomas Rooney, and 50 authors in 32 chapters talk about our changing ecology here in Wisconsin and a little bit about what we can do about it as well. So really pleased to have him with us today and pleased to have you listening. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.